the Ethics of International Development Projects. And this paper, I'm an author of this paper. Also, Brian Thomas, who spoke yesterday afternoon about the work in Honduras, is a co-author of this, and we will talk a little bit about what we've done in Honduras as well. Ryan McGee, who's a former graduate student of mine, he got an Master of Engineering and an MBA here at Baylor last December, and he has spent a good share of this year in Honduras working on the project there. Some of the background is I'm trying to think through putting several different concepts together. This paper is in some ways built upon the work in Honduras. Brian Thomas is the lead one on that. I spent a week in Honduras in the summer of 08 and been significantly involved in that project. In Austin this summer at the ASEE conference, I present a paper about ethical issues related to international development projects. And we're going to add a Christian spin to it, for lack of a better term. And that overlaps a paper I presented 3 years ago at Campus Crusade's National Faculty Leadership Conference, where I defended a Christian version of virtue engineering ethics. So what we're going to do today is combine virtue engineering ethics to development projects. So kind of our outline, I want to make a few brief comments about virtue ethics. Some of you may be very familiar, some of you may not be. How does virtue ethics relate to Christianity? Then how does it relate to engineering? And then how does it relate to international development projects? I think many people who would look at virtue ethics see this as coming ultimately from Aristotle, who lived in the 300s BC. He was a student of Plato. And Aristotle began by looking at the final goal or final purpose of human beings. And he concluded that our final goal should be well-being. Well, so he said we need to seek well-being in our life. And he says that can best be done by leading a virtuous life. This kind of approach to ethics doesn't look at decision-making skills as some do, but the idea is that good people make good decisions, so strive to be a good person. And he came up with four what he called cardinal virtues of prudence, temperance, fortitude, and justice. About 1,500 years after him in the Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas added the virtues of faith, hope, and love. So when you hear the term cardinal virtues or classic virtues, sometimes you just see the first four, sometimes you see all seven. And that leads to Thomas Aquinas. He made Aristotle's views, which had kind of languished, very popular again. And most of his adult life identify with him. He was a university professor. So he spent most of his time doing university things. We've had people in the last 30 years do things about virtue ethics. One of the best-selling books in the early 1980s was William Bennett's The Book of Virtues, and then he wrote a sequel to that. In a more philosophical sense, Alasdair MacIntyre has wrote a book called After Virtue, A Study in Moral Theory, where he tries to revive virtue ethics from a philosophical point of view. Bennett was more concerned. He told lots of stories supporting virtue ethics. So one of the questions that came up is, how do you relate virtue ethics to religion? When I first submitted this paper to the ASEE 3 years ago, just a secular version of it, one of the reviewers said it should be rejected because it's religious. So is virtue ethics inherent religious? I would say no. I don't consider Aristotle to be a religious figure. Yeah. And there's a lot of cultures have embraced virtue ethics. Carolyn Whitbeck, who's written a well-known engineering ethics textbook, and this is a quote from her book, she talks about the notions of a moral rule and that of virtue have been explicitly used in a larger range of cultures than has the notion of a right, because a rights ethics approach is popular in our culture today. She says virtually every ethical and major religious tradition employs some counterpart of the notions of virtue and moral rule. So how does the virtue ethics relate to the Bible? I'm not going to claim that virtue ethics is the biblical approach, because there's a lot of biblical approaches to ethics. But I'm going to try to make the point that it is consistent with a biblical perspective. So I'm going to look at just three of the classic virtues for time purposes. The classic virtue of justice concerns our will and is concerned with truth and fairness. And you see these two passages in Proverbs 2. for to do what is right and just is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. In Micah, you know, quoting God, he has showed you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. Hope gives us a confidence about the future. Paul writes in Romans 5, since we have been justified through faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have gained access by faith into this grace in which we now stand, and we rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. And in Jeremiah 29, which is one of my favorite passages in the whole Bible, for I know the plans I have for you, declared the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. The classic virtue of love, John 4, 1 John 4, is a passage talked about God is love. And then in 1 Corinthians 13, that whole chapter is about love. And Paul ends that chapter by saying these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. So my point is that the seven classic virtues all reflect character traits that the Bible strongly recommends. So I would say that if someone is following a virtue ethics perspective, he or she will be living a lifestyle that's consistent with the Bible. So I make the point that a virtue ethics perspective is compatible with the Bible. I know many other Christians who have adopted other perspectives that are also compatible with the Bible, but this is the one that I've come to embrace over the last 10 years or so. So how does it relate to engineering? I first heard of virtue ethics, because I'm not a philosopher by training, in Martin and Schinzinger's classic ethics book that came out in the early 1980s. They mentioned virtue ethics and rights ethics and several other approaches. There's a fascinating book that came out in the early 2000s by Seebauer and Berry called Fundamentals of Ethics for Scientists and Engineers. And what they've done is they've developed a secular version of virtue ethics and say this is what you should base engineering practice on. And I presented a paper that overlaps their concepts at ASEE 3 years ago. So how can we relate this to the issue of international projects? Well, I need to give you a little bit of a background about what we've done at Baylor. We initially, in the early 2000s, started doing service engineering projects in developing countries. And if any of you heard Brian Thomas's talk yesterday, that's had mixed results. You know, it dramatically changed the lives of the students, but sometimes did not have a long-term effect upon where we're working. So we're moving more to doing development projects because of sustainability issues. And Brian talked a lot about that yesterday. So how we do that? Within the College of Engineering and Computer Science, the largest student group, bigger than any traditional professional society, is a group they started about 6 years ago called Engineers with a Mission. It's very obviously patterned after Engineers Without Borders, but our students wanted to have an explicitly Christian group to do that. There are many Christians in Engineers Without Borders, including myself, but it's by design a secular organization. So they want an explicitly Christian group. We've done projects, you see, in all these countries. This summer, I was in Rwanda, and Brian Thomas was in Honduras at the same time with engineering students from Baylor. So, service learning and poverty. Many of the service learning projects we've all done relate to poor people or poor communities because they typically cannot pay for someone to design engineering things for them. This, as Brian talked about yesterday, is considered a bottom-up approach to poverty. We're not talking at the governmental policy or foreign aid level. We're talking about changing individuals and poor communities. And instead of a trickle-down, it's more of a trickle-up approach, working with the people directly. So what are some ethical issues? There's a lot of them. I want to look at three of them. One's quality and safety in your design. One's liability. And one's, what's your relationship to the community you say you wish to help? Safety issues. Everything that we build has a finite probability of failure. So we need to minimize the probability of failure, but also try to minimize the severity of the failure. And let me make a couple of comments about the differences between that. The probability that we can accept depends upon how severe it is. You don't want a high probability and high severity problem. But if the severity is low, you may accept a higher probability of failure. For example, many men, including myself, accept the fact that there may be a failure. It means I cut myself during shaving. And for me, that's not a severe problem. Now, if you're a hemophiliac, then it is a really big deal. But if you're not, this is a failure that I'm willing to accept from time to time. If it's moderate, you must still keep the probability of failure low. And one of the example would be, I accept a lot higher probability that one of my electric lights will fail than my car axle will fail. You know, if an electric light fails every month or so, that's no big deal. But if my car axle failed every month or so, that would be a very big deal. So let's look at virtue ethics applied to that. The virtue, I think, of prudence requires us to be careful in our calculations. A lot of times when we do international projects, it's on top of what we're already doing. We need to be very careful we're not just giving our extra time when we're bored or tired. It may be extra time in the sense your employer may not be paying you for it. Now, I'm privileged that at a Christian university, my employer, in effect, is paying me to do some of these things. But you need to give the best of our talent. You know, it may be throwaway time, but it's your best of your talent. And certainly the virtue of justice demands that we not implement projects that will have a high likelihood of hurting lots of people. But let me give you an illustration of that. Dr. Bradley in his talk yesterday showed some pictures of a very neat bridge over the Galena River in Kenya. And I was part of a group with him and several students who designed that bridge. We had, in the fall of 07, we'd basically finished our design. And it looked very similar to a bridge that was in Nepal, except that bridge collapsed. At the end of a major festival, there's lots and lots of people on the bridge, and a number of people died. Here's a picture of that bridge. What that did is we totally redesigned that bridge in the next 2 months because our design, while we weren't aware of their design until this collapse, had too much similarities to it. So we decided we need to change the way that this bridge is being built. And Dr. Bradley showed you pictures of the bridge over the Galena River yesterday afternoon, if you're in that session. Liability says that the virtue of justice requires that we accept a moral and legal responsibility for what we're doing. And I need to make some comments about these last 2 points. If we're not in the United States, we're not bound by United States laws. And that's it. So we may be able to do things in other countries, in Kenya or Rwanda, we cannot do here. But that doesn't mean we should do things that are unsafe. Just because we don't have to obey all U.S. standards doesn't mean that we should ignore the ideas behind the standards from the United States. I think many engineers would say sometimes the U.S. standards may be stricter than necessary, and we may not use them all in a developing world. But we shouldn't just ignore the rationale behind the standards of the United States because we don't want to do something and make something crummy there just because we are allowed to do so. Because many developing countries have no standards or very little legal standards. Community issues is one we need to think through. In traditional design, the engineers try to design what the customer wants. But one of the issues we face is, when you're working with the community, is who is the customer? You know, the idea, Dr. Bradley quoted Paul Pollack about the need to talk with the people who are going to use your project to make sure that they really want it. Frequently, when we work with groups in other countries, we're working with nonprofits who say they're acting in the name of the local community. And the question is, are they really? They may be, but they may not be. William Oakes and Mary Beth Lima's book about service learning, which is really largely about U.S. service learning, raises some issues that need to be addressed. And one is, how does your design affect the community? We don't do a good job in engineering of teaching about social implications of designs, and we need to do better in that. They make the point that engineering in the developing world needs to be done in a democratic way. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean we have elections on every design issue, but it does mean the local community needs to be significantly involved in the decision-making process. And this is very consistent with both the virtues of justice for the community and love for the people we are seeking to serve. Let's look at an example of community involvement. I visited Rwanda in January of 2008 with a group called Bridge to Rwanda. And I went there looking for potential engineering projects, but I didn't come into the Sunrise School here and say, here's what you need. I asked them, what do you need? You know, and the local people said they've got some problems with water, they've got some problems with electricity. So we took a team there in May of this year. One of the things, they had water from the grid, but the water wasn't very good. Here you see two students testing the water. They boiled their cooking and drinking water before using. So what we did is we put in a water purifier. I'll show you in the next slide. But we wanted to see what's the water quality of what they got right now. And we found that after boiling it, they had more bacteria than before they started. They either insufficiently boiled it and just warmed it so the bacteria could grow, or they had contaminated pots and various other things. When we first got this result, we did the prudent thing. Before we told them, I said, let's repeat the test to make sure we didn't make a mistake, you know. But we repeated the test and confirmed that their boiling was hurting themselves, not helping themselves. So we put in this water purifying system and connected it up to the kitchen. The hoses aren't all connected to the kitchen at this point. But one of the things is, do you really believe in the quality of your work? I think one measure of how prudent, justice-supporting, and loving you have been is, are you willing to use the design that you have done? So we did. We were the first people to drink the newly purified water. And they saw that we Americans didn't get sick, and that gave them extra evidence to believe this would work. As we began doing more development projects, we've begun to work on areas of creating companies that can help sustain them, as Brian Thomas talked about yesterday. And I think he gave a reference to Calvin Beisner's book, Prosperity, Poverty. And he basically says anything that's unjust is ultimately not going to be very efficient economically. And anything just is ultimately going to work. It may not work immediately, but it will ultimately work. And this is also a book that Brian mentioned about, we begin to see the poor not as just people that need our help and that we, in a patronizing way, will benefit them, but we're going to see the poor as their customers. And that has a significant impact on your own attitude, that if you see the customer as real people. And here you see a picture of the typical customer of our work in Honduras. They make $4 to $5 a day. Now, that doesn't sound that much to us, and it isn't. But that compares to the average of less than $2 a day in Rwanda. You know, the people I saw in Honduras, this family is doing vastly better than the average family in Rwanda. They're not doing very well by U.S. standards, but they're still, $4 to $5 a day gives them a little bit of flexibility. So as we see them as customers, I think we're seeing them as real people with real needs, and we're showing, more, I think, love to them. And that also means we want to create something that they want to have. If they're customers, then they can tell us what is it they want. You know, so we're showing respect for them, and we're showing love for them, that their desires are legitimate and important. So the village-level electricity projects we've done in Honduras, we're creating a small amount of electricity on the order of 1 kilowatt. That's not very much, but that could power 30 homes in a church. Some of the ethical issues we need to deal with is, for whom is the for-profit company serving? Obviously, the company needs to make a profit if it's going to sustain itself, but making a profit cannot be, from a Christian perspective, its only goal. I think the virtues of justice and love demand three things. We talk about our company being triple bottom line. This is an example of that. We've got to treat the employees fairly. Now, that doesn't mean paying them a wage that you'd pay them in Waco, but paying them a fair wage by Honduran standards. We need to treat the customers fairly. We also need to treat the investors fairly. If we're going to ask people to give us or invest money in our company, we need to give them some hope that they themselves will get a return. So what we're creating, a company with what we would call a triple bottom line. It's got to make money to survive. We want to help the people in multiple ways, the people who are getting jobs. Those are new jobs to the community. We're helping people by providing them electricity. Brian Thomas showed you yesterday
You know, the story of the lady who's starting a sewing business now that she has electricity. We want to help the environment because we're doing things that are less polluting. And that's very helpful. So the idea is the company will only be judged successful if it fulfills all of these goals. So an example of our work in Honduras, we believe it can generate a modest amount of profits for the investors, can generate income for villagers. Here's the lady with the sewing business now. We believe it can help people improving education. Here you see a little girl reading her Bible by a decent amount of light. Enables you to have more productivity. Their quality of life is better. And it evokes a sense of hope and dignity. Now, when we improve their quality of life, we've got to let them judge what is an improvement. When our team was there in May, there was some qualifying meet leading up to the World Cup, and the whole village gathered in the one home that had a TV now that they have electricity. Basically, almost the whole village was there to cheer on the Honduran team. Yeah, that is what they saw as important. So that's important to them. Our electricity, this is very grandiose in terms of helping the planet. This is if we sell thousands of these systems. You know, we can help get rid of the amount of kerosene that's built, you burn, the amount of CO2 that's thrown into the atmosphere, and the amount of damage by just throwing away batteries. Now, this would be if we have several thousand of these, and now we have two. So we're not going to have a big impact on the environment this year by any means. But if you adopt this technology widespread, it can help. So kind of as conclusions, engineering service projects have, I think, a unique set of ethical issues. A Christian ethical perspective requires us to make sure that we are safe and that we also have community support for our projects. And development projects have the added complexity of the for-profit company. And I think it's important from a Christian perspective that any companies we create in the developing world be triple bottom line companies. Again, we've got to make money to survive. We've got to help the people. And we need to have some positive impact on the community and on the environment as well. Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions? We have time for a few questions, and then we'll need to lead it on to Ken. Yes?
Yeah, well, that water purifier that you installed was a good example of sustainability. What I imagine that there are parts that require maintenance and things like that. How do you do that?
We had extra parts. This was a water purifier that had been sitting around at their place for a year and a half unused because they didn't know how to work it.
Yeah.
Someone put it in and put it in a place where they could never connect it up. So we moved it in right next to the kitchen, mm-hmm. and we trained their people and we brought spare parts. Yeah. But the point is some well-meaning group put in this thing that works great, but in a location they could never use it.
Yeah.
You know? So if we didn't design that system, but we designed it in the sense of moving it and connecting it so they could really use it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The question?
Actually, the same question I had as far as the sustainability of the water system. I actually have been doing a water reclamation research project that essentially emulates the processes of the earth. So it's extremely sustainable from that standpoint. I just wondered if you had used any of those same principles.
Well, we're trying to. I mean, this one works largely by chlorination and filtration, and certainly the filtration would be a relatively natural process. Another aspect of sustainability is we don't just go here and then we'll never see them again. You know, we've developed a strong relationship with this, I'd say, remarkable group called Bridge to Rwanda, and by the time we left, we'd already decided on next year's projects, part of which will be to look at this system and make sure it's all working. That's not why we're going to go back in 2010 fundamentally, but that's part of what we're going to do. And I would encourage any of you doing development projects is to think long term. I'm expecting to go to Rwanda every year for the next 5 to 10 years, you know, mm-hmm. with students. Okay, yes?
On the bridge redesign, can you tell us, you know, basically what the major change was?
We originally had the bridge, for lack of a better term, the supports kind of like pin-loaded so they could rotate a little bit as people walked over it with tension. But the problem is when they had too many people after that festival, they just rotated too much and they collapsed inside. So we have a more rigid support at each end now. A number of people have used this kind of pin-loaded approach for small bridges, but this group had never built a bridge over a 300-foot river before. So it's a more rigid system. That meant it's more costly. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. I'm going to introduce our next speaker, and then even though I'm session chair,